Wednesday, November 1st, 2023. You are listening to the Daily Dose Sports Podcast, and I am your host, Clint Daly, coming to you from the Mile High City here in Denver, Colorado, and we are back for another week of talking sports with a dose of common sense. Hey, happy Wednesday to you. Hope your week is going well. Hopefully, Halloween was good for you. Maybe you got your favorite candy. Hopefully, you didn't get egged. No toilet paper on your house this morning when you woke up, or any, you know, bad language spray painted on the front of your house. I hope you, your family, your friends are all staying strong and you're all staying healthy. And don't look now, but Halloween is over. And yes, we are now reaching the holiday season. That's right, kids. We are just weeks away from Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's. Might want to start saving those pennies now to be able to afford all the things we're going to have to buy, right? It's coming fast. However, this is actually a good thing for me. Because when you think about my hometown Denver Broncos right now, hey, all their gear is on clearance right now. Hey, I'm telling everybody, on the Christmas list, you better get ready for some Bronco gear, because I know they're terrible, but hey, here's a Russell Wilson jersey. I got it for $4. Enjoy. Let's ride. That is the deal this year. I'm getting all the discount stuff. Hey, before we jump in today, just want to remind you, make sure you're stopping by DailyDoseSports.com. We have new articles going up every week. We have links to the podcast. We have links to the YouTube video. And yes, we have links to Daily Dose gear. Speaking of those holidays, maybe you need to pick up a t-shirt, a sweatshirt, a hoodie for the holidays. Go ahead and get one from DailyDoseSports.com. Got a number of styles for you to choose from over there, and you can pick whatever color it is that you would like it in, which is always kind of nice. Hey, today on the show, I actually have a few things I need to take care of this week. But never fear, because I have put together some clips from the very early days of the Daily Dose. I'll be honest, it's a little tough for me to listen to these, but we are going back to some clips from way back in 2015. And if you were listening back then, you know, we actually started in December of 2014. So these are very, very early Daily Dose shows, but we were discussing the NFL. We were discussing college football. We discussed some rules that you should always follow when you are playing fantasy football. We also remember some past Daily Dose top fives. We count down the top five most impactful NFL preseason injuries. We count down the top five reasons that college football is absolutely amazing every year. We count down the top five most dangerous NFL hitters in the history of that league. We count down the top five most significant NFL quarterback injuries. And we count down the top five biggest NFL kicking blunders of all time. Yeah, covering a lot of things this week on The Dose. So sit back, relax, and enjoy some of the best of the Daily Dose Sports Podcast. I got another email here that I gotta read to you. I got an email from, says from Brian J. It says, hey, our fantasy draft is next week. Do you have any tips for my fantasy team? I do have some tips that I wanted to share with all of the listeners out there that tune in every week. I wanted to give you a few fantasy team tips. And I'll be honest, I'm not a huge fantasy guy. And based on some of these tips, I'll tell you why I'm not a huge fantasy guy. But I wanted to give you some tips because I know one of the reasons that the NFL is so big, the NFL football is so big, especially in the U.S., is because of fantasy sports. It really is. People love having that rooting interest because it's the NFL isn't just regional. Like with baseball is a regional sport. If you're in, you know, St. Louis, you cheer for the Cardinals. If you're in San Francisco, you cheer for the Giants. And if you're out in New York, you cheer for, you know, the Yankees, you cheer for the Mets, whatever. Football isn't that way. Like, if there is a Monday night football game on and it's a big game, it's Packers versus Vikings in week four, you're turning it on and you're watching it. And some of the reason is because of fantasy sports. I understand that. I get that. I've got,
I've got Adrian Peterson. I've got to tune into that. I want to see how he does it. You know, I'm hoping I need big points tonight because I did okay yesterday, but I need some big points tonight. Fantasy sports kind of drives a little bit of our huge audience that we have for professional football today in America. It just does. And so, Brian J writes in and asks if I have any tips for his fantasy team. Of course, I'm going to break down some tips for the fantasy team. Let me put together a few here for you. First off, and maybe this is what kind of drove me out of doing a lot of, I used to do like every fantasy league that came along, I would kind of do them. Hey, you want to get in fantasy league? Yeah, whatever. Here's $10, whatever. And did pretty well. I mean, won a few leagues. But here is one piece of advice. If you want to, you know, get a pencil, write this down. Don't draft players that you hate. That is one free piece of advice I'm going to give you. Now that might not seem like a big deal. Might not seem like a big deal at all. But if you draft a player you hate, you end up becoming kind of torn on, do I want this player to do well who I don't like? I mean, now you've kind of got to go through and you've kind of got to be selective. And when you're putting together your draft list, you've got to kind of make sure. Now, if Tom Brady comes up, am I going to take him? Because, I'd really like to see him do poorly this year. Do I really want to take a guy like that? Do I want to skip him and go down to the next quarterback on my list who I like a little better? And then I'm not going to be torn in my allegiances. My advice to you, because that was the thing that started to bother me about fantasy league. I started to have to cheer for players and for teams I didn't like. I can remember clearly being, right around first or second place in one of my fantasy leagues. And I had Tim Brown at the time. And he was playing for the Raiders. And I was like, I need Tim Brown to have a huge night tonight. Oh, and he's playing the Broncos. Oh, perfect. Perfect. That's exactly what I need. So I'm telling you right now, go through, find the players you don't like and that you say, I hate. And maybe there's only two or three of them. You might not be someone that hates a lot of players. If there are certain teams or certain players that you're just like, I cannot cheer for those guys, weed them out of your fantasy draft list. Get them out of there. Number two, thing that I would give you advice wise, don't have any more than like two or three teams that you have fantasy teams. Like if you're getting into like the 5, 6, 10, 12, yeah, I got 12 different fantasy teams. I'm getting a little concerned about you, I guess is what I'm saying. You might have a little bit, is mental imbalance the word I'm looking for? Something like that. If you're playing that many fantasy teams, it's kind of like, remember when we talked about back in March Madness, we talked about how many different brackets did you fill out? And you say, well, yeah, in my 14th bracket, I definitely picked that upset. Yeah, well, yeah, who cares? Oh, you can really only like put in any attention and really be able to be good at like two or three at the most. If you're playing much more than that, either you have a lot of spare time, you're not really doing a good job and you're probably wasting money throwing it into these, or something. Or like I said, you've got a little bit something that you might want to get a team of like a therapist to look at you for, but two or three teams at the most. That's really the most you can do. Number three, don't have your draft prior to the final preseason game. And I know that gets kind of tough. That starts to get a little bit tight because a lot of you, I believe Brian said, our draft is next week. Well, here's the problem. You're going to have these Jordy Nelson situations. You're going to have the Marquise Pouncey situations that could greatly change the way you look at someone like Ben Roethlisberger. Is he going to have Le'Veon Bell, someone like that? I would pick this player, but now with these injuries through preseason, that might tweak a little bit of what I'm going to do. That might change a little bit of what I'm going to do with my draft. I would encourage you, have your draft that weekend. They usually play those last preseason games on like, you know, Thursdays and Fridays, and have your draft that weekend after those games, because you could have some cuts, you could have some injuries, you could have some people shifting around, and you don't want to get into your fantasy league that's going to last the full season and things be not what you thought they were. Try to delay that draft as long as you can and get into the closer to the regular season so that at least you're drafting the people that you really do want. Last two I'll give you. First off, don't ever refer to your draft room as the war room. So like you're having all your buddies over to do your draft and you're like, hey, everybody meet in the kitchen because that's the war room and I've got the big whiteboard. It's not a war room. It's your kitchen. Don't say that. Don't say that. You're not a general. You are a tool. If someone does say it, and you can tell them that I said it's okay, if someone refers to like your living room or your dining room or whatever of your house as your war room, because that's where you're having your fantasy league draft, you have my permission. You can use this. You have my permission that you can punch them in the face, neck, or throat, and it's totally okay. That's you have free hits based on that. I don't know how legal any of this is, but I'm just telling you, you have my permission to punch them in the face, the neck, or in the throat for saying the words war room when referring to the room that you're conducting your draft in. Now, the last rule when it comes to Fantasy League, the last rule, and I'm just going to throw this out there. Whatever you do, make sure you abide by this rule. You can ignore the other four rules if you want to. I'm fine with you ignoring all the other rules on this draft, on the fantasy football tips that I'm giving you. I'm fine with it. If you just remember this one rule. Number one on my tips for fantasy football. Number one, without question, whatever you do, never talk to me about your fantasy football team, because I really don't care about it. And you know what? Neither does your wife, and neither does your coworker, and neither does your boss. It's big to you. Here's the way I would compare it. Like, have you ever tried to like write poetry? Now, to you, that might have been something really, really eloquent, and it might have been really something touching in it. Trust me on this. Everyone else just kind of thinks you're a weirdo. So don't share that information. Just keep that information bottled up. Keep that inside. And you don't have to talk about your fantasy team. Trust me on this. You don't have to talk about your fantasy team. Nobody else cares. As we do every single week, we have got to get to our Daily Dose Top 5. Like I said before, very, very popular segment. Whenever I get feedback, I'll get some emails, I'll get some tweets, I'll get some random things. I almost always hear about the Daily Dose Top 5. Love the Top 5, disagree with the Top 5. I've had people that have written me, and we did a little bit over the summer where they said, just do shows of Top 5s. We try to do a good Top 5 for you every single week. This week, we got something a little relatable, something that's going on right now. We are going to count down the top five most brutal NFL preseason injuries. Now, when I talk about most brutal, I'm not necessarily talking about gruesome, although some of them were. I'm talking about impactful and preseason injuries that were just horrible. We have these every single year. We have somebody's getting injured in preseason in a meaningless scrimmage, in a meaningless practice. And you know, you look at Jordy Nelson, you look at Pouncey this year. Jordy Nelson wasn't even touched. The knee just gave out. It's not always controlled. It's not always where you said, well, if they weren't having contact, we wouldn't have these problems. Sometimes these things just happen. But I'm going to count down the top five NFL preseason injuries of all time. Here we go. Number five on our list. You might remember this one. 1999, Rams versus Chargers. It's funny when you look back at this, because the St. Louis Rams in 1999, people were starting talking about the Rams. They had put together these pieces. They had put together some wide receivers. They had put together a pretty good offensive line. And their quarterback, Trent Green, was going to be the man to lead this, what became the greatest show on turf. But in a preseason game against the Chargers, he gets blasted by Rodney Harrison. That one was pretty gruesome. That one was pretty ugly. I'm sure there's probably clips out there that you're not going to want to see. Trent Green blows his knee out. And Dick Vermeil, the head coach of the St. Louis Rams, had to go to his backup, a little known backup that really hadn't played much, hadn't played big time college football. We didn't know anything about. Trent Green went on the injured list, and out came Kurt Warner. And the rest, I guess, as they say, is history. Kurt Warner became one of the greatest quarterbacks, honestly, one of the better quarterbacks to ever play. Really, really good. Really, really smart. Understood exactly where to go with the ball and was absolutely unafraid to be blitzed. He encouraged teams to blitz him because he knew he could find the right guy and deliver the right pass. Trent Green goes out in 1999, lost his job, never did get his job back. Kurt Warner took it and kept it. Number four on our list, bad injuries in the NFL preseason. Same year, 1999. You might not remember this. Chris Spielman had put together a pretty good career. He had played with the Detroit Lions. He had had a good career with the Buffalo Bills as well. He actually had a neck injury in 1997. In 1998, his wife was undergoing cancer treatment, and so he took that season off and spent with his wife trying to help her through her cancer treatments. In 1999, Chris Spielman returned as a member of the Cleveland Browns. During a preseason game against the Bears, he actually sustained another neck injury. Pretty sad story. Spielman never played again. It just ended, ended his career, retired. He had to get out of it because they were saying that anything further on that neck could result in paralysis, could result in some really, really bad things. Chris Spielman went through a really, really tough time through those years. That kind of ended it for him. Preseason game against the Bears. And that was kind of it for Chris Spielman. Number three on our list. Are you old enough to remember this one? You might not. This guy was a pretty good player, and he was only like two or three years into the league, and they were starting to say he was going to be a really, really good player coming down the stretch. Cornerback, kick returner, punt returner. He had actually asked his coach, "Can I return kicks and punts?" Because he was so quick. And when the Giants allowed Jason Sehorn in 1998 to return some kicks in a preseason game, they quickly regretted it because Jason Sehorn, like I said, he had begged to kind of start taking these kicks back, and they put him back on. And the first one he did, I think he broke it for like 25, 35 yards. And then the next one, he blew out his knee, and Jason Sehorn was never the same. He never had the same speed. He never had the same ability, the agility that he had had to cut and to find a receiver when the receiver was making his cut. He never fully got it back. It kind of ended Jason's. He came back and he played a couple of seasons, but he was never the same as he had been before that. Jason Sehorn, our number three preseason injury. Just one of those ones that kind of wrecked a career. Number two on our list. You might not know this one. Do you remember the old Police Academy movies and Moses Hightower and some of the beer commercials that Bubba Smith was in? Well, in 1972, he was playing for, at the time, the Baltimore Colts. And, back in these times, in the 70s, when you had the yard markers, you know how you're marking the first down with the sticks? And if you ever notice, when a play comes over to them, they drop the sticks and the sticks just fall flat and the line just goes straight to the ground. This is why. Because in a 1972 preseason game, Bubba Smith ran down a ball carrier into the sideline. And at the time, you just jammed the stick. The stick had the pointy end at the bottom of it. You jammed the stick, and the sticks just stayed straight up to mark the first down. He actually got tangled up in the chain, blew his knee out, tore his knee up. They say it's one of the worst knee injuries that they've seen in the NFL, all because he got caught in the chains of the yardage markers. He tore up his knee. He missed the full 72 season, ended up getting traded, getting moved around, never was the same. Bubba Smith went down in a preseason game and kind of a dumb injury, just getting tangled up in the yardage markers in a preseason game. Number one on our top five NFL preseason injuries, and this one is absolutely unforgettable, 1978. New England Patriots quarterback Steve Grogan. I know most of you Patriots fans, if you're listening, you just heard me say quarterback Steve Grogan. What? Who's Steve Grogan? The only quarterback I ever knew of was Tom Brady. There was another quarterback before Tom Brady. Yes, there was, and his name was Steve Grogan. Anyways, Steve Grogan throws a quick slant to a wide receiver by the name of Daryl Stingley. Stingley was hit immediately by Oakland Raiders safety Jack Tatum. Hard hit. It wasn't dirty. It wasn't like it got any flags. It wasn't anything gruesome or that you looked at and said, oh, that could be something really, really significant. Not at all. He went down, but Stingley went down and he never moved again. It actually, the hit caused Stingley's spinal cord to compress. It broke his fourth and his fifth vertebrae, and Daryl Stingley would never walk again. He was a quadriplegic for the remainder of his life. He ended up passing away, actually pretty early. Kind of a darker finish to that list. But those are our top five NFL preseason injuries. And you just don't know. Every time these guys strap it up, is that danger is always, always out there lurking. And sometimes, things like this happen when you play a game like these guys play. There are preseason injuries out there that can always take place. As we do every single week, we bring you our Daily Dose Top 5. And I've told you before, the Daily Dose, you never know which way it's going to go. It can entertain, it can inform, you don't know. But this week, because it is the college football preview, I wanted to run down the top 5 things that make college football so great. Because you might be sitting there and saying, you know what, I'm not a college football fan, college football wise. Like, I watch the NFL and I have my NFL team, but I'm not a college football fan. But you got to realize, college football is so exciting. I'm a huge college football fan. And I'm here in Colorado where we barely have college football. But the thing about college football, they have the traditions. They have the pageantry, the college kids that are just crazy, the drunken coaches that are slurring things at these booster nights. College football is a lot of fun. And I'm going to give you 5 reasons that college football is so great. Number 5 on our list, the pregame. The traditions of what schools do prior to the game. Let me give you a couple examples. You know, down at Ole Miss, they do the champions walk. So from the athletic complex over to the stadium, the players walk in between, just lined with fans, where fans are cheering for them and fans are having kind of a parade for them. And the players walk all the way over to the stadium in front of the fans. They call it the champions walk. I don't know why they call it the champions walk. They haven't won a championship since like the 60s, but it is the champions walk. And there are a number of schools that have kind of started to take that. Ohio State, prior to their game, their band goes out and spells out Ohio. And then we wait to see who's going to dot the I that week. As you know, usually it's one like sousaphone player. They yell to him and he runs out and he takes a bow and dots the I. Just a tradition that goes on in pregame at some of these schools. Texas A&M, you might not realize what they do down at Texas A&M. Did you know that the night before home games, they have these called yell leaders? And they actually, kind of organize these pep rallies all over campus. And they teach new cheers to people that are going to be going to the game. And they actually teach you how to yell. They show you that, you know, when you put your hands kind of down on your thighs and you lean forward just a little bit and the way you open your mouth, you can get more noise out of your, diaphragm and everything. And you can actually make more noise to make that loud noise down at Texas A&M, and become the 12th man down at that stadium. They have yell practice the night before games at Texas A&M. And then Army Navy. If you've never been to an Army Navy game, you've never been to a service academy, we are lucky enough here in Colorado. We have Air Force. I've been to a number of Air Force games. I've seen them play Army. I've seen them play Navy. But what they do for the service academies is the cadets march in formation, in lines, and then they line up on the field. And then when they dismiss them, they all run up to their seating up in the stadium where they stand, and they put on quite a show the entire game. But seeing those guys all marching in formation, pretty incredible. The pregame is definitely one of the reasons we love college football. It is cool. Number 4 on our list, the entrances. The entrances into the stadium, because teams enter the stadium a number of different ways. A couple examples. You go to Tennessee, and Tennessee, the band makes a big T. They make a big outline of a T, and when the team comes running out of the tunnel, they run through the T. Down at Miami, we spoke before how they run through the tunnel of smoke and kind of trying to make it look like a hurricane. They've got the hurricane sirens going. It's pretty exciting. It's pretty amazing. If you don't know what goes on at Clemson and Howard's Rock, they call it the most exciting 25 seconds in college football. Because back in the day, their old coach, Frank Howard, had told his players, if you're going to go out and you're going to give 110%, then you can touch this rock. If not, keep your filthy hands off of the rock. So they actually have, their tunnel is actually up a little bit above the stadium. They touch Howard's Rock and then they run down out of the tunnel down onto the field. They call it the most exciting 25 seconds in college football. Clemson has a great entrance when they come into the stadium. And the last one, got to talk a little bit about Virginia Tech. and Enter Sandman. If you haven't seen it, go to YouTube and just Google search Virginia Tech Enter Sandman. When they get ready to come out, they play Metallica's song Enter Sandman, and the place gets so insanely loud, you can't hear the song. That's how loud it is. Exit Light, Enter Night, Enter the Hokies. Entrances into college football are one of the reasons we absolutely love college football. Number three on our list is the mascots. Hey, the mascots are pretty cool. And I'm not a huge mascot guy. Like, for me, the mascot could be like the San Diego Chicken and what is it, the gorilla down in Phoenix. That's enough mascots for me. But the mascots in college football are really cool. Obviously, down at Auburn, War Eagle, you have Abby, the live golden eagle, who the legend of was that a Civil War soldier had rescued this, I don't know, sickly hurt eagle and had nursed it back to health and had kept it on campus. And right before they were getting ready to play Georgia in, like, I don't know, the 1800s, the eagle flew up and around the stadium to rally the fans. And ever since then, Abby, the golden eagle, flies up and around the stadium before the game and at halftime, and everyone yells War Eagle at this bird. I don't know, but it is cool. Brief side note, I was at an Air Force One game, and they actually do the same thing. They fly a falcon up around during halftime, and the falcon hit a pigeon in midair and then proceeded to chase it down and devour it during halftime. Great show for the kids. You got to love the mascots. Colorado. And I know I'm here in Colorado, but if you haven't seen the five handlers try to control a 1,300-pound buffalo as it runs 25 miles an hour out into the onto the stadium field, it is pretty awesome. And I've seen that in person a number of times. Ralphie the Buffalo puts on quite a show. You know what's kind of funny? I grew up north near, not too far from Boulder, a little ways. On Saturday mornings, if you were out and about at some of the local car washes, you would many times see Ralphie out getting a bath at the car wash. They would be soaping her down. And it is a female, because the males just get too big. But they'd be soaping it down with the scrub brush and, you know, getting it all ready and getting Ralphie all pretty. You know, Ralphie runs about 25 miles an hour. Just as a frame of reference, you know, Usain Bolt runs about 27 miles an hour. Now, they're not running, you know, as fast as he is. And a lot of the times those handlers are kind of getting drug along. But that's pretty fast. And that's why you see sometimes they'll have an announcer. An announcer will try to go on and be like, oh, I'm going to run with a buffalo. No, you're not. You're going to get drug around behind the buffalo. Colorado's Ralphie, pretty impressive in person. Last mascot that I wanted to talk about, Mike the Tiger down at LSU. You know, they have a live tiger in like a cage that they bring out to like one of the corners of the field. And Mike the Tiger comes out and just kind of stalks his prey. And you know what they do at LSU that's kind of cool? And they only do it for the home games, but they usually place Mike the Tiger in his cage right outside the visitor's tunnel. So when you get to come out, you get to come out and maybe he roars at you and screams at you, and then you jump and have to run out and try to play your football game. Always trying to intimidate. LSU and Mike the Tiger, one of the great mascots in college football. Number two reason that we love college football, the post games. And some traditions are actually after the game as opposed to before the game. If you take a school like the University of Kansas, if Kansas beats a decent team, I know, it's rare. Jayhawks fans, though, will run out on the field. They'll tear down the goalposts, and they'll drag the goalposts down the hill to Potter Lake and throw the goalposts into Potter Lake. I don't know why. I was actually there for a game and witnessed them doing this, but they do it every time they get a decent win. They go get their goalposts and they go throw them in the lake. Army-Navy, when the game ends at Army-Navy, they go to each other's, you know, their section, their fan section where their cadets are and everything, and they sing the alma mater. And the goal at Army-Navy or any of the military schools is you always say, we want to sing second. Because if you lose the game, then you sing your alma mater first, and the team goes over to the student section, and they stand in front of them, everyone sings the alma mater, and you sing the opposing team's alma mater too. It's kind of that sign of sportsmanship. Hey, we had our game. It's over. We respect what you do. They go sing the alma mater with the losing team, and then you go to the winning team, and you sing with them. The goal is always seeing second. And then one of the other, and one of the biggest post-game traditions that you have, again, down at Auburn, downtown Auburn, down in Alabama, across from this, there's a store called Toomer's Drug that's been down there forever. They actually had these two massive oak trees in the lot across there. And after big wins at Auburn, fans would go over, they call it Toomer's Corner, and they would go over and they would just throw tons of toilet paper over these giant oak trees, and they call it rolling Toomer's. So after a big win at Auburn, you go and you roll Toomer's Corner. In 2011, some Alabama nut poisoned the trees that were 75 years old, and so they've actually had to stop that. They had to take those trees out, and they've actually got a few new trees going in. They were planted in February, and I think they can resume rolling Toomer's Corner again next season. Just one of the cool things that happens with college football. You don't get this with the NFL. You don't get this with other sports. These are just kind of distinct things that happen in college football only. And the number one reason that we love college football is the games. The games are great. The games are entertaining. It seems like you have more finishes that are just crazy. You have more scoring. You have just a ton of excitement. The fans are so much more into it than they are at a professional game. The Hail Marys, the different kind of games. I'm just going to give you one quick story. And I've seen a ton of college football. I've seen some amazing finishes, amazing bowl games, amazing regular season games. And we can talk about a number of those over the next few months as we enjoy the college football season. I just want to give you one that just kind of sums up college football. In 1988, Auburn goes down to Death Valley in LSU. One of the toughest places to play that there is in LSU, where those people are out tailgating and cooking every single thing you can think of outside in a barrel, you know, to make some sort of Cajun stew. And they're out there, and Auburn takes a 6-0 lead. It is LSU ball, 4th and 10, with 1:47 left in the game. For LSU, it's do or die. You score a touchdown here, you convert this first down, and you know, continue on, but 1:47 left. LSU, you've got to make a play. LSU quarterback Tommy Hodson finds Eddie Fuller in the end zone. LSU wins the game 7-6. You say, big deal, 7-6. Who cares? That sounds like a boring game. There were 79,431 fans at Death Valley in LSU that night. When the touchdown was scored, fans were so loud that it caused a seismographic reading on the LSU campus. There were windows broken. There were windshields in the parking lot broken. It caused basically an earthquake. That is college football, and that is what we love about college football. As we do every single week, let's jump over to our Daily Dose Top 5. And our Daily Dose Top 5 comes to us this week from Mike in SoCal. Mike in SoCal emailed me. Mike is a pretty regular contributor to the show. We have a couple Mikes that contribute to the show, but Mike is a pretty regular contributor to the show. And he emailed me, and we were talking about some of the greatest hitters in NFL history. And then we kind of started talking about, well, who are the greatest hitters like right now? And I'm going to be honest, we couldn't come up with any greatest hitters right now. Cam Chancellor? Rashad Jones down at Miami, TJ Ward, maybe here in Denver. I don't know. The game has changed so completely. You can't be a hitter in the NFL anymore. Hitters are as extinct as the dinosaurs because of the rules, because of the way that they officiate these games. We don't have hitters anymore. So I'm going to go through today, and we're going to count down the 5 greatest hitters in NFL history. But I'm telling you right now, we don't have greatest hitters anymore. These are going to be the greatest hitters ever of all time. Done deal. Because it is over. That part of football has ended. And here in a few years, they're probably going to be playing flag football. And I understand. I'm not complaining. I understand these guys, the issues they have, the head injuries, the physical ailments. I'm not necessarily arguing against it. I'm just saying it doesn't happen anymore. We don't have great hitters anymore. Doesn't exist. They have been legislated out of the league. Let's count down the Daily Dose top 5 greatest hitters. Number 5 on our list, Got to go. He played for the Rams. He played for the Cardinals. He played for the Lions. And it's before my time. I'll admit it. It's before my time. But I've gone back and looked at the film, and Dick Night Train Lane was absolutely vicious. The videos that you see of Dick Night Train Lane, they are violent, violent hits. He was a guy that they had to ban clotheslining for. The horse collar was still legal, but clotheslining, he would just go by and just try to get guys' necks everywhere he went. They used to call it the Night Train Necktie. And I'm telling you right now, if you go Google search, Dick Night Train Lane and some of his hits, they are violent, violent, horrible hits. Definitely one of the greatest hitters of all time. Number four, I'm going to stay here in Denver, and I know you can call me a homer if you want to. I'm going to go with the Denver Broncos, Steve Atwater. You know, everyone remembers the Christian Okoye hit. You know, that was back, what, like 93 or something. Christian Okoye, the big giant 260-pound running back for the Kansas City Chiefs, comes through the hole. Atwater popped him, knocked him backwards. That isn't even the play that stands out. As much as that play put him on the map, and as much as that play has been replayed, I want you to think about the way that Steve Atwater played in Super Bowl 32. Couple plays I want you to keep in mind in that game. Super Bowl 32, when the Broncos played the Packers, upset the Green Bay Packers in that Super Bowl. The first touchdown of the game, the Packers go right down the field, and Brett Favre hits Antonio Freeman in the back of the end zone. Steve Atwater tattoos him on that play. Now, that might not seem like much, but you have to remember the Denver Broncos had been to the Super Bowl and failed miserably. It made me wonder when he hit him, this looks a little different. Because I remember the losses to the Redskins, to the Giants, you know, to the 49ers when, you know, these guys were catching and making plays and no one ever made them pay for it. Atwater popped him in the back of the end zone, one of the first plays of the game. He had the big sack on Brett Favre, caused a fumble. And then late in the game, just a, you know, 30 seconds left in the game or something, Packers are driving. Steve Atwater actually knocks out Darian Gordon, his teammate, Robert Brooks, and himself. On one play, you actually see Atwater make this collision with his teammate, and you see his whole body just goes dead, and he just hits the ground. Steve Atwater was a hitter. You had to be aware of where he was. They called him the Smiling Assassin. He would knock you out anywhere on the field. Number three on my list, and I know I'm going to have some people argue that this guy should be higher, but it's my list. When you make a list, you put him where you want to. I'm going to go with Chicago Bears, Dick Butkus. Dick Butkus was just an absolutely ferocious tackler. And I'll be honest, a lot of the plays, when I go back and I watch, you know, some of the YouTube videos and stuff of Dick Butkus, this is a guy that was kind of going out of his way trying to injure you. Giants general manager Ernie Accorsi, he described Dick Butkus maybe the best way you could describe him. When he hit you, you stayed hit. Kind of a good way to describe Dick Butkus, who comes in at number three. Number two on our list, I'm going to go with San Francisco 49er safety Ronnie Lott. You know, Ronnie Lott started as a cornerback. He was shifted to safety, and he actually was built and played like a linebacker. Dude had no problem sacrificing his own body to just knock someone out or just put his body on the line. He would throw himself into violent, violent collisions. I'm sure you are aware of the story that he had a piece of his pinky dangling off of his finger that they were afraid was going to keep him out of the game. So he went over and, cut it off himself. Ronnie Lott, one of the toughest and most ferocious hitters. Again, if wide receivers, running backs, quarterbacks, if you were going to be in Ronnie Lott's area, your head had to be on a swivel because he was going to come take your head off. Number one on my list, the Daily Dose top five greatest hitters, I am going to give to the Oakland Raiders, Jack Tatum. Now, I want to throw out just a couple of brief stories about Jack Tatum to describe to you why he is on my list. First off, if you ever watch the old clips, I want you to be very, very aware of what is on his forearms, because his forearms... He always had the tape going up from wrist, you know, to elbow. I don't think that was just tape. I'm going to be honest. I think there was probably, I don't know, maybe a hardening agent. There was something going on there because he used his arms like battering rams and he would just club guys in the head with those forearms. You might not know. And again, this is one you kind of have to watch the YouTube video of. But when Jack Tatum was playing, he had a move that he called, I believe he called it the hook. And what he would do, and if you watch some of the old clips, you'll see him do it. What Jack Tatum would do when he hit wide receivers, he would try to get his arm around their head. And right as he was going by them, he would flex it and tighten it and try to pop their helmet off of their head. I believe, like I said, he called that the hook. If you keep an eye on some of those old YouTube videos of Jack Tatum, you will see him trying to remove guys' helmets off their head. He did it quite a bit. Pittsburgh Steelers coach Chuck Knoll, he actually was trying to pursue criminal charges, saying there was a criminal element to the game that Jack Tatum played. You know, if you remember the Immaculate Reception, the pass from Terry Bradshaw to Frenchie Fuqua that got deflected over Franco Harris catches it. Tatum absolutely crushed Frenchie Fuqua, the wide receiver on that play. I still think that play was illegal just by how the play was. But anyways, Jack Tatum, probably the most vicious and nasty hitter that I've ever seen. Saw him in a full-on head-on collision with Earl Campbell, the huge running back down at Houston. They both kind of teetered and tipped over sideways. And of course we remember the horrible situation we talked about, you know, with the preseason game, where Daryl Stingle, the wide receiver for the New England Patriots, was paralyzed. Jack Tatum was a vicious, vicious hitter. And if you were on the field against him, it was very, very, scary. Something that you knew he was coming and he was looking for you. He was going to try to inflict punishment on you. Jack Tatum, our hardest hitter on the Daily Dose top five. And like I said, we're not getting any great hitters anytime soon. They are dinosaurs. They are gone. Got to say thank you to Mike out in SoCal for throwing that list out to us, talking about great hitters. As we do every single week, we have got to jump over to our Daily Dose top five. And you know, we talked a little bit earlier about Tony Romo going out and what that injury could do to the Dallas Cowboys. Cause I know Dallas Cowboys are sitting there at 2-0. They've beaten two divisional teams. You know, they beat the Giants. They beat the Eagles. You're sitting in a pretty good spot, but you just lost your quarterback. And that's a big loss and it could be impactful. And I want to talk about five of the worst quarterback injuries that were impactful for their teams. Sometimes it really, really hurts to lose that guy. Daily Dose top five worst quarterback injuries and how impactful they were to their teams. Number five, in 2004, there was a young quarterback that came into the league from Central Florida, and it was starting to look like he was going to be great. In 2004, Dante Culpepper had 39 touchdowns to just 11 interceptions, and everyone was starting to look at him and say, hey, it might be coming. I mean, he might be taking Minnesota to the playoffs, having them in contention. It was starting to look like Dante Culpepper was kind of getting it going. And in game 7 of 2005, Dante Culpepper had a horrific knee injury. Tore three ligaments in his knee. Tore the ACL, the MCL, and the PCL. And Dante Culpepper was never the same after that. The Vikings fell off. They never could quite get that back. It took them a few years to get back to the playoffs. But, 2004, Dante Culpepper, he looked like he was the next big, big thing. Number four on our list, impactful quarterback injuries. Joe Namath. We all remember that the Jets won, or maybe not remember, but you've probably heard in the history books at least, the Jets won the Super Bowl III in 68. In 69, the Jets made it back to the playoffs and they lost to the Chiefs. But here's what you might not know. And the Chiefs went on to Super Bowl IV. But in 1970, Joe Namath broke his wrist in game 5. In 71, he blew out his knee in the preseason. The Jets actually ended up going like 10-18 over those seasons, and Joe Namath was never the same quarterback that he had been. It's a good thing they won that in Super Bowl III because they never got back there. They never got it really that close, and Namath just suffered from health issues from there on with the knee and the wrist. Number three, this is one that I really remember. Number three, one of the most dynamic players ever to play in the NFL game. If you don't believe me, go YouTube this guy. Because in 1993, the Philadelphia Eagles looked like they might have a shot to be one of the big dogs. They had one of the most exciting players ever to play in Randall Cunningham, and they were loaded on defense. They had Clyde Simmons, they had Seth Joyner, safety Andre Waters, they had cornerback Eric Allen. The Eagles were 4-0, And Randall Cunningham had won Offensive Player of the Month. You know, he had 5 touchdowns thrown already through the first 3 games. It looked like the Eagles might be the team in 93. He ended up blowing out his breaking his left fibula in game 4 versus the New York Jets. And from there on, Philadelphia went 4-8, finished 8-8. And that was kind of the end of that Eagles run. They had some chances for a while. They had the very good defense. They couldn't get offense. They got Cunningham. They got very good on offense. They couldn't get the defense. And then he got hurt. And it just kind of ended that little run for Philadelphia. They were one of those great teams that never quite got as far as maybe they should have with all that talent. Randall Cunningham, one of the most exciting players, was never quite the same after he broke his leg that year. Number 2 on our list. And this one, it didn't kill their season completely, but they didn't make the playoffs. If you look back at the numbers, you say, well, they still went 10-6. But in 1985, you might remember when the Washington Redskins were playing the New York Giants at home on Monday Night Football. And Joe Theismann, they were at least in playoff contention. Joe Theismann, Lawrence Taylor went in and broke his leg for him. I don't mean just broke it. I mean, that's probably the worst, memorable injury that a lot of people can still recall, when Joe Theismann had his leg broken, broke the tibia and the fibula. And here's the thing, you know, like I said, the Redskins went 10-6 with Jay Schrader taking over. They didn't make the playoffs. It ended Joe Theismann's career. He never played football again. Very, very impactful injury to another quarterback. And number 1 on our list of impactful quarterback injuries, you know, in 1999, the San Francisco 49ers had some pretty big hopes. They had gone 12-4 in 98. They had gone 13-3 in 97. They had gone 12-4 in 96. It kind of felt like the Niners were building towards something special. Maybe this was going to be the year that they get back to the Super Bowl. But in week 3, the 49ers faced the Arizona Cardinals. And on a blitz, cornerback Aeneas Williams just laid out quarterback Steve Young. It was his 7th concussion, and it ended Steve Young's career. Didn't ever play again. The Niners ended up going 4-12. That season, and that was kind of the end of that little run that they had with Steve Young. I believe Jeff Garcia ended up coming in and taking over like 2 or 3 years later. But that kind of crushed the season for the San Francisco 49ers. I would hope that's not the way this season goes for the Cowboys, but when you lose that signal caller, you lose that leader, and we know Tony Romo can be kind of goofy at the end of games, but Tony Romo's pretty good. The Cowboys losing him, You just never know how it's going to affect the Dallas Cowboys this year. As we do every single week, we have got to get to our Daily Dose Top 5. We talked a little bit earlier in the show about the kickers struggling in the NFL this year. We have seen kickers missing at a way higher rate than we normally think of. Are they fragile? If they miss an extra point or they miss a kick, do they then miss 2, 3 because it gets in their head? I don't know. But as a result, we're going to do our Daily Dose Top 5 NFL kicking blunders. And I know what you're thinking. I know as I'm reading this right now, I know what you're thinking. You're going, well, you're going to go with Scott Norwood in the Super Bowl. No, I'm not. I'm not going with Scott Norwood. A 47-yard kick? That's not a chippy. I'm talking about blunders. I'm talking about things you should get right. I'm talking about that's a tough, tough kick. You shouldn't. I mean, 47-yarder? That's a tough kick. If you missed that, well, yeah, I missed it. It was a tough kick. His offense should have got him a little more yardage. Daily Dose, Top 5, NFL kicking blunders. Now, first off, I'm going to give a quick honorable mention. We don't always do honorable mentions, but I'm going to give an honorable mention on our Top 5 this week. In 2006, you might remember the wild card game, the Dallas Cowboys versus the Seattle Seahawks. The Cowboys are down by 1 with just over a minute left in the game, and they have a 19-yard field goal to win the game. But Dallas Cowboys quarterback Tony Romo botches the hold, tried to run, didn't make it, game over. Now, that wasn't so much a kicking blunder, which is why it gets on the honorable mention, but it was in the kicking game. Plus, it's always kind of fun to poke fun at, you know, Cowboys fans. So let's move on to our actual top 5. Number 5, top NFL kicking blunders. In 2001, while playing for the Arizona Cardinals, Bill Gramatica hits a field goal to put the Cardinals up 3-0. Not a game winner, or not even a long kick. It was a 42-yard kick. And the Cards weren't even very good this year. They were 5-8 at the time. But when he kicked it, Bill Gramatica jumped around like he had just won the Super Bowl, blew his knee out, and ended his season. Yeah, that makes our list of kicking blunders for sure. Number four on our list, you might remember this one, 2003 with John Carney. It was a regular season game between the Jacksonville Jaguars and the New Orleans Saints, and the Jaguars were up 20-13 with just 7 seconds remaining in the game. The Saints are at their own 25-yard line. And so you're looking at it and you're going, there is no way that the Saints are going to win this game. You're going to have some kind of crazy Hail Mary kind of play. Well, yeah, they did. Saints quarterback Aaron Brooks throws to Dante Stallworth, hits him at about the 50. And Stallworth actually breaks two tackles. They somehow don't get him down. And he runs to the Jacksonville 34. He pitches it to Michael Lewis, runs to the Jacksonville 25. He pitches it to Deuce McAllister, runs down kind of toward the sideline to the 20 and stops, throws it clear back across the field to Jerome Pathan, who runs it into the end zone. The Saints did it. They actually pulled off, you know, the hook and the lateral and the lateral and the lateral, and they somehow find the end zone. And then John Carney went on for the tying extra point. And this wasn't the extra point we have now that's a little tougher, and missed the chippy extra point. The, you know, 18, 19 yarder, he missed it. So they still lost. That is number four on our list. Number three on our list, might remember Super Bowl 38. You know, Super Bowl 38 was supposed to be kind of a New England Patriots blowout. The Patriots were 14-2. But somehow, the Carolina Panthers surprised everyone by getting there. And with just over a minute left in the game, Carolina quarterback Jake Delhomme hit Ricky Prohl for a 12-yard touchdown, and somehow Carolina tied the game at 29. It was tied with just over a minute left. And then Carolina kicker John Casey kicked off, and he kicked it right out of bounds. It wasn't planned. That wasn't what John Fox had ordered. He had ordered him just to kick it deep, kicked it out of bounds. So Tom Brady and the Patriots get to start at their own 40-yard line. The Patriots just have to go 36 yards. Of course, they went 36 yards. Adam Vinatieri kicks a field goal. Patriots win. Thanks, John Casey. Number two on our list. Got to be in 1998. You know, Minnesota Vikings were putting up huge offensive numbers in 1998. Their kicker, Gary Anderson, had gone 35 for 35 on field goals. Hadn't missed a kick all year. They were favored by 11 versus the Atlanta Falcons in the NFC championship game with about 2 minutes left. They were up by 7, and Anderson came in to kick a field goal that's going to make the game a 10-point game, a two-score game with just 2 minutes left. This game's over. Minnesota is going to go to the Super Bowl. And then Anderson missed a 38-yard field goal. Somehow the Falcons get the ball back. They go right down the field, send it into overtime, win the game. The Falcons go on to the Super Bowl. Gary Anderson missed his first kick of the season in the NFC Championship game. And our last one, our number one entry on our top five NFL kicking blunders. And I'm going to be honest, this one isn't as costly. I mean, it didn't cost his team a chance to go to the Super Bowl. It didn't hurt his team in a Super Bowl. But I'm telling you, this kicking blunder makes our number one because it's just gorgeous. It is just for sheer beauty, it makes our list. It is such a pretty, pretty blunder. It is, I'm telling you, go back, find the YouTube video. You will enjoy it. Every single time I watch it, I laugh. You know, 1972 Miami Dolphins were the only team to go undefeated. And in Super Bowl VII, they were up 14-0. There's just over 2 minutes left to play. And Miami's going to kick a 42-yard field goal that's going to ice the game. It's going to put them up by 17. That's going to be the exclamation point, game over. Except that the kick got blocked. And the ball is live. And the ball goes back to little kicker Garo Yepremian. And Yepremian picks it up. Now, dude is like 5'7 and like 175. He's a little guy, little bald guy. He had come over, I want to say from like Greece or something. And his famous quote was, "Aikike touchdown." Dude picks up the ball. He has no idea what to do with it. Instead of just laying on it, saving the possession, yes, they're going to take over. The Redskins are going to get the ball back, but they're going to get it back at about midfield. Big deal. He decides he's going to throw the ball. If you have ever wondered what the average person would look like throwing an NFL ball in a real live game situation, this is what you would look like. You might not think you would. You might think you would step in and look, like Aaron Rodgers or something. You would look just like this. He tries to throw it. He loses it. It goes over his head, and Redskins quarterback Mike Bass picks it up and runs it back for a touchdown. And now it's suddenly a 14-7 game. And the game comes down to an onside kick. They say on the sideline that Dolphins linebacker Nick Bunicotti told Yepremian, "If we lose this game, I'm going to physically kill you." The Dolphins recovered the onside kick and held on to keep their undefeated season intact. Number one on our list, 1972, Gary Yepremian. He wins for the top five NFL kicking blunders of all time. I'm telling you, go YouTube it. It is classic. It will make you laugh every single time.
Hey, next week on The Dose, we will be back to our regular format, and we are actually going to be joined by a friend of The Dose. We need to check in on that college football season. We are now just past the halfway point. So, who are the biggest surprises? What about the teams that have been a big disappointment? We're going to be breaking down all that we have seen so far in the world of college football, and what we might still expect in this 2023 college football season. So make sure you stop by the Daily Dose and make sure you let a friend know to do the same. Hey, I want to say thank you to each and every one of you for listening to the Daily Dose every week. Thank you for the emails. Thank you for the texts. Thank you for the tweets. Thank you for going over to DailyDoseSports.com and checking out the new things going up there every week. But more than anything, thank you for sharing the show, for sharing the videos, for sharing the articles with someone that you know. We absolutely love it when you do that. Have to say thank you to JSP. Could not do any of this without you. I will see you all next week. I will see you all next Wednesday. Have a great week, everybody.